welcome to the Cardboard Herald, my chance to talk with creative gamers and game creators. As always, I'm your host, Jack, and today I am feeling mighty professional. And that's because I got a table-mounted mic sitting in front of me, hanging down like some cool podcast booth in some awesome studio somewhere. And it's even got this cool shock mount thing that's springy and absorbing all sorts of vibrations and making sure it doesn't interrupt this awesome, cool, crisp, clear audio that is coming right to you. But that isn't the only reason why I'm feeling professional today, because I have, as a guest for you, Dr. Reinar Knizia. Yeah, that's right, the good doctor of gaming has come on the Cardboard Herald, and I am overwhelmed. Like, seriously, this is something that I would have never dreamed about 6 months ago, or even 2 months ago, but surely enough, the man is just a humble, awesome dude who wants to share games with the world and share his experience with the world. And he was willing to do that on the Cardboard Herald. Maybe it's that he was begging for a new venue, or maybe he just saw something in my approach to him. Whatever it was, I am so honored to have him on. I mean, this guy has done so many games, and whether or not you're into the very Euro-specific games that he's designed, and sometimes not so Euro-specific games he's designed, but there's definitely a flavor to a Knizia game, you can't deny this guy's impact on everything that follows. I mean, just endless amount of iteration has been done on Knizia games. And even in this podcast, if you listen to some of the prior guests, they cite his games as the source of inspiration for things to come. I mean, Bruno Catala specifically mentioned the Lord of the Rings cooperative game as a source, a citation of inspiration for what was to come with Shadows Over Camelot, a game that also had an enormous impact on this industry. And I don't know, it was just unbelievably cool to sit down and talk to him. He was so put together. I was probably in a hoodie or something. I had to wake up super early in the morning, like many of my interviews with European guests. And he, of course, came on with the signature bow tie, and we talked about it all. We talked about his career. We talked about his decisions. We talked about his impact, particularly in the late 90s and early 2000s. We talked about games that are coming out now, the projects that he's got upcoming, how people treat him as this legendary, iconic figure. I mean, you'll hear it all. And it was just a pleasure to be able to speak with Dr. Reinar Knizia. Man, you know, if you're looking for an entry point to his games, there's so many that you could go from, but of course, the classics, the ones that I really love, definitely check out the Lord of the Rings cooperative game, because of course, I'm a Lord of the Rings geek, and man, I gotta tell you, side note, the Sauron piece from that is my favorite game component of all time. It's the Tower of Barad-dûr, to be more specific, with the red eye, and it's this cool, abstract, like heavy, heavy duty piece. Ugh, so good. And then, of course, you have Tigris and Euphrates, probably the most revered of his games. Then there's all kinds of other stuff. Just recently, I got a chance to play some Samurai with my buddy Dan. And I mean, that's the cool thing about his games, is they hold up. I mean, they feel of a time, but they don't necessarily feel dated either. And maybe some are, but I think they're designed so smartly that they still deliver on such a specific concept that no game has truly captured what he delivered in some of those iconic classics. So I could go on and on, but instead, without further ado, the Cardboard Herald is proud to present Reinar Knizia. Ugh, I can't believe I got to say that.
I'm a 24 years ago, I went to from Munich, actually, mm-hmm. to England just for 18 months. I was at that time still working for a bank, and I went over there to manage their subsidiary in England. And out of these 18 months came more years and more years, and I changed jobs and finally decided to jump and become a full-time game designer. And so after 24 years, I thought, well, 18 months and 24 years is quite a different relationship. And I never wanted to stay in England for good. So it was sometime time to come back. And there were lots of reasons that now is the right time. And yes, the Brexit and the whole development is one reason, but by far not the most important reason. And with respect to business is very international. So it doesn't really matter if you sit a few hundred miles north or south. It's a lot of international contacts. So we have moved, and once we have survived all the boxes and the unpacking of the boxes, we will continue as we've done before.
Yeah, well, it must have been quite the move. I mean, among board game designers, tabletop gaming designers, you definitely have been certainly the most prolific, but also one of the most successful to have an entire office and infrastructure move over to from one country to another. Must be a significant change, but also kind of a relief to be home. Were you, I imagine that you are constantly traveling as a game designer and also a game speaker. Do you find yourself giving talks and lectures and that kind of thing?
First of all, I enjoy it, and I think if I really wanted, I could do a lot of traveling and fill my time with traveling, talking, giving lectures, discussing things and so on. But I'm trying to be very disciplined and not to do this. Because my task is not to travel the world. My task is not to be a salesperson to the publishers. It's something I enjoy and which is part of the business. My job is not to stand in front of people and entertain them. My job is not to give lectures at university. All of this is very enjoyable and very tempting, but all of this is only based on one core thing we're doing, and I'm doing, and this is design good games. And if I stop design making nice products, all the other things fall by the wayside. So I must be careful that I dedicate enough time to what I and what we do best, and that is create new games and get them published through competent publishing partners. So it needs a lot of discipline to say no and disappoint a lot of people, because there's just not enough time in the world to do everything that is fun and that is on the table. So I'm trying to focus and do the most important things, and that which brings most enjoyment to the people, and that where I reach most of the people.
Well, let's talk about that then. Designing games, you know, you seem to be a very disciplined person. You were talking about being disciplined and the importance of focusing on game design. What does a typical day look like for you when it comes to game design? Do you wake up in the morning and have a list of projects that you're going to be working on? How do you approach game design mm-hmm. now? And how has that changed from 25, 30 years ago when you were first getting into game design?
Okay, if we talk about the now first, I think it is well known that I'm an early bird, and this is just in my blood. When I was at school, I got up at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not that extreme anymore, so I get up at 4 o'clock. Oh. And the beauty and what I really love about it is, apart from being fully awake and being really concentrated in the morning, because I am a morning person, is the peace, the quietness, no telephone calls, nothing happening, and I can sit there and really creatively for a few hours think about new designs, think about new games, mainly what happened the last evening when we tested games, and really have that peaceful time with my best concentration to work on what I want to do most. And then usually that goes into the, not every day is the same, of course. This, usually that goes far into the morning, and then sometime, so to speak, the business side catches up with me. So I would sit together with Karen or with other people who help me, and we would go through the days, we could go through the new events so that they can go off and do their things. While then also I would look at emails, look at other commitments. And then in the afternoon, later afternoon, I would again concentrate on the design part, because for me, game design is something which the core of game design is playing games. It's experiencing the games, it's getting the emotion of playing. And with this respect, I have to play myself, and we play a lot almost every day. And that means these playtests need to be prepared. I know which questions I have. I know which changes I want to introduce. And so as the playtesters, the people are usually having a decent, normal day-to-day job. They come in the evenings and we play most time in the evenings or on the weekends. And so this will all be prepared. The changes will be done to the prototypes, and then we will test. Testing, I think we'll talk about testing in a second, any a bit more in detail, but testing means discussing and playing and looking at changes and bringing me results so that the cycle starts again. When I get up the next morning, I have all the test results from the evening before. I would look at the experiences, the positive surprises, and most of the time the negative surprises and disappointments, what didn't work. And then I would start thinking about it, going deeply into designs and making changes, suggesting changes, outlining changes. And then again, in the afternoon, when I come back to these, I would implement these changes and prepare the new tests.
Well, you mentioned people with a decent job who are playtesting your game, you know, your friends, your colleagues, the people who are actually investing their spare time rather than their full time assisting you with the development of these games. You know, it's such a fascinating part of your story that many years ago you famously quit your banking career in order to focus on full-time game design. And at that time, this designer market of board games wasn't nearly as large as it is now. And I imagine that must have come as a shock to your friends and family that you are quitting to focus on board game full-time. Was that a significant risk for you that your image would change from this very professional person, which you are still extremely professional? You even have a bow tie on right now and you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. But you were changing from a decent career to one where you were essentially making toys for people.
Yeah, it wasn't a shock, and I don't think the risk was that big. It was very well thought through. It wasn't a decision out of an instant, not a decision out of a month. It was a process over 2-3 years where I very carefully thought, is it the right step? Do I want to do it? And it was also kind of course, knowing that once you are in a relatively senior management position, that I ran a company with 300 people and about £1 billion of new business in the mortgage side every year. That was before the big banking crisis, and so I think I got out in time, but that's another story. So I knew once you get out of management, you go into something weird like game design. You cannot decide after 2 years, I took a break, I go back. This is just, you're kidding yourself. I knew very well this is a one-way jump, so I thought about it very carefully. But the risk wasn't that big because, firstly, I had some savings. My earnings were not bad in the banking side. The rumors that you get big bonuses are not all untrue. But it's also that I wasn't completely unestablished in the gaming world. I had won my first German Game Prize I had quite a number of publications. Some of the classic games were already out, which are still out today. We're still in publication today. So I understood what the business was about. I understood that I could do some good games. And so it was more the drive of saying, I never have enough time. And I'm split between these two worlds, the management job, which took a lot of time, the game design, which takes a lot of time and energy. And so I just wanted to say, I'm the person who tries to dedicate himself fully to one thing. And so I decided I'd rather go for the games where my heart is, because you've only one life. And so essentially, the decision was taken. I did it. I have never, ever regretted it. It was a perfect decision for my life.
And why was your heart there? What is it about designing games that brings you such joy and gives you such a passion for it?
Yeah. I more and more recognize that the real passion, the real ability, the real drive for something develops in people very early. In England, where I lived, I had a neighbor's son, who is now 12 years old. He is fascinated by games and by acting. By movies and by acting. And he goes for auditions. He makes his own little movies and stories. He does things I could never imagine to do. And he shows them to us on his television and so on. And his personality, his acting, for a 12-year-old, is absolutely impressive. And so I think you see very early, if people start playing tennis, they play tennis before they are 10 years old. And so you see this passion, what they develop, and that's what comes from their inside out. And I think everybody has it in them. Not everybody finds it. Yes, that's the thing. And for me, it was always the games. It is funny. It was the games which I loved to play, because I didn't have enough pocket money, and there was no game shop in the city I grew up, in the town I grew up. Just the barber sold a few games. and so I soon came around to saying, okay, I have topics, I have themes, I have worlds which I would like to play, and we did our own ones, never in this sort of publishing them, just for the love of games. I think this is one of the fascinating aspects of the gaming world and gaming industry, that everybody who comes there is driven by the love of games. That's something we really share in common. Otherwise, why would you be there? Yes. And that makes our world, our industry, our business, a really colorful world with lots of colorful birds from all different sides. If you go into banking, they have all got their suits and they have all got one direction. I think it's much narrower mindset than you find in the world of games. Everybody's driven by the love of what you do, and it's something which really gives a very positive aspect to society and to culture, and that's very rare to find actually in a profession.
Have you retained a singular focus on game design since you originally went to it full time? Like, has there ever been any time during your history of designing game after game where you've thought, maybe I can retire from this, or maybe I can move on to a different passion that I have? Or have you remained just as passionate as you are clearly today?
The passion is still there, and there is no desire to do anything else, because if the desire were there, I would certainly do it. I mean, nobody forces me to design games. A lot of people ask me, why do you not go into publishing? Because even though it's publishing of games, it's the same industry, it's a completely different field. And it's, I'm not kidding myself and say, because I think I can do one thing very well, then I can also do all the other things very well. And then you started, so to speak, half-heartedly, and then you run into challenges or problems, however you want to call them, and then you take more of your management time. Soon you're only dealing with setting up things and building structures, and you no longer do hands-on what you really want to do. That's why I keep my current business very small. I don't want to build a big organization. I don't want to build a big publishing company, because all you do is manage. I don't want to manage. I want to really design the games and be in the core of that design process, yes.
That's great. As someone who I work for the Alaskan government, and going from a job where I was managing 25 people to now only having three people aside myself on a team. It is such a relief. It allows me to focus on actually doing the work a lot more rather than managing people, which is not a passion of mine, certainly.
This is exactly the point, that there are gifted people and people who really thrive on running companies and building companies, starting up companies and making them big or developing them further or reorganizing companies who are in trouble. It is different. We are not all the same. So it's different passions, and everybody is best there where they follow their own passion. And I think this misguidance of, I mean, I've seen that when I worked in bigger businesses, that everybody takes their value of how many people do I manage, yes, and the people who are very, very strong from the actual factual, from the business point of view, they are specialists, yes. They usually do not get valued as much as people who manage 50 people, yes. And so there's an imbalance there, and you try to do that with the titles, but it's still how much do you value them, how much do you recognize them, regard them. And you need to find your own value in it. I mean, it's running after other people's values and recognition usually drives you off your own path. So you need to stay true to your own path, and once you do this, I believe you will be successful, and you also will earn your money, which you need for living, because you do a good job. And it's, you know, competing with me is only possible if you love games, because I don't work. I think day and night about games, but it's not work for me. If you want to compete with me, and it's not you personally, but somebody else, and it's work for them, they've already lost, because it's far too exhausting for them. And so you can only compete if you really do what you love, and then it's very hard that other people compete with you unless they do the same and love it. And yes, it's the world of the universe of games is unfortunately not all mine. I share it with some other enthusiastic people, but that's how it goes. Those people who live for it are successful in it and are actually shaping the different industries of the different areas. I mean, like Steve Jobs lived in his world and tried to make big contributions. And I very much admire Steve Jobs, because I think he changed our world in our times, probably like nobody else. Yes,
monumental impact. Yeah.
Yes, and these impacts, and he was. I mean, he was more looking at the big. I mean, people have different theories about Steve Jobs, and I unfortunately have never met him. But it's just people who are absolutely dedicated to what they do, are convinced of what they do, and then try to make it happen.
Let's talk about some of these games. You know, you have over 30 years at this point in designing games, dating back to the days where, or 30 years in publishing games, I should say, not just designing games, because you've been doing that since you were a child. But you have 30 years of publishing games, including your initial start in publishing magazines, and then progressing into some of the most monumental games in tabletop gaming. I mean, you look at things like Raw, Samurai, Modern Art, and of course Tigris and Euphrates, which many people consider the greatest strategy game of all time. They've had an incredible influence on the future and the development of the tabletop gaming industry, and you're still continuing to publish games. What, around 600 games at this point?
Yes, that is. I mean, I think it is. It depends always how you count. Is it the same game, a different game? But I think it is around 600 different games, and of course they spread out into far more than 2,000 individual editions in different languages, different graphics, and so on, different.
2,000 editions. Do you find yourself ever revisiting your games that are, they're published, they're done, but you know, for your own pleasure, do you ever go back and play some of your own designs?
Well, that is one of the challenges about lack of time. And when I talked before about having to decide whether I want to go into management, see, is high-level management, or if I want to go into games, I can only do one because I don't have enough time. It hasn't really changed because I think it's a mindset, and I want to put every hour I have into game design, and so I still haven't got enough time. And that also means whenever there is an opportunity to play, I have 60 drawers here, which potentially can have 60 different designs, which I want to move on. No sane person can drive on 60 designs, not even close. But nevertheless, they are there, and said something about my sanity. And so it's when the opportunity arises, my favorite games are always the ones I'm working on. And having the 60 as a side remark also is a good selection process, because one of the dangers a designer can undergo is actually to fall too much in love with his designs and then spend too much time on a design which does not lead anywhere. But with this, so to speak, natural evolution, always the ones who are most promising, they come to the forefront. And that means having quite a number of different games helps me to stay focused on the ones which fly the best in a way, yes.
Well, many of your games, including the ones that I mentioned, are often considered by modern gamers, you know, the people who are online, actively part of a community right now, are considered these classics, but also abstract games, which I find interesting because it's clear that theme is so incredibly important to you as you design games. You know, just looking at something like Tigris and Euphrates, of course there's an abstraction of conflict, but just because you're representing that by laying down tiles as opposed to having plastic figures move across a board doesn't mean that it's any less thematic. In your own approach to design, do you start with mechanics or do you start with theme, you know, or is it interchangeable?
This is a very good question, a question which I'm not asked the first time. When I started designing, my core fascination was always the theme. And so the theme, car racing, an auction, whatever it was the starting point. And then I would set my scientific mind. I'm a mathematician, I'm a scientist, mind to it and try to abstract out of it, distill out of it the core pieces of what does it actually mean. Not the meaning with respect to how many event cards do I need to do with little events and little details, but more how do I feel in a car racing? How do I feel in an auction? Yes. So the typical thing is, I'm not having if it's about trends, I'm not having an event card that says a new trend arises and you gain €50 for this or $50 for this. But I'm then creating more, if I want to talk about trends, I'm creating something in the game where you suddenly see, oh, he has bought it and he is now buying it and it becomes more valuable. So I actually let people feel the trend themselves, create the trends themselves. So in a way, my theme is for many players a bit more removed, a bit more abstract, a bit more undercover, so to speak. It is the you live it, you feel it yourself. It's not 100 little details in the game that essentially give you all that rich theme. It's more the emotion which I'm trying to create to reflect the theme. And you mentioned Tigris and Euphrates. If you look at the times there, then this was not a stable time where essentially everything grew up and grew bigger and the civilization grew bigger. It was a big turmoil where the kingdoms came and dynasties came and collapsed and reunited differently and different coalitions. So it was a coming and going all the time, and there were lots of intrigues and lots of things going on, power plays going on. And what I try to do in Tigers and Freights reflects this but it, not in a way to describe the whole process and to give all these pieces of information, but just to let it come out of the mechanism. So you play there and it suddenly happens, it builds and then it collapses again and it comes together because you expand and then the tiles come together and then you get a war and the war destroys everything and everything falls apart again. And then you rebuild from there and it's different structure. And so my approach to theme is different. My approach to theme is the emotion, is the what do I want to feel? And that's what I try to, as a scientist, try to distill into the games. So painting black and white, I think there are two types of people. There are the people like me who are scientists who reduce redundancy. So I'm trying to bring back the game to a very core fundamental principle or a few of them, so that once you understand these principle, everything flows from it, but you have a lot of own freedom to shape what you're doing, and therefore every new player in the game will actually make the game different. Yes. And then on the other side, there are the storytellers. I mean, I'm also a storyteller in my game, but I'm probably a very, very quiet storyteller, not using many words. And then there are the real storytellers who use many, many rules. Look at the Lord of the Rings, yes. And they create lots of redundancy and they put lots of individual details in there. And the whole game just explodes by little bits and pieces. And sometimes the rules, therefore, become quite a bit longer and you have lots of special rules and lots of special things. And a lot of people like this because they say, okay, all the elements to discover in there, but it's a different approach. It's more an administrative approach to have all this to run the game. The game is usually much more run by itself rather than by the players. And so it's different approaches and there's no one game for everybody. There are different approaches and people can pick what they like best. And I know I have my style of design and there are lots of different styles. And that's the beauty of our industry.
Well, you mentioned Lord of the Rings, and I have to ask about this because I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan. Both the game that you designed, or games set in Middle Earth that you designed, but also the written work, the movies. I am just a big Tolkien geek, and I was surprised when I was doing a little bit of research leading up to this interview that the Lord of the Rings, the board game, the cooperative game that you designed, released a year before Peter Jackson's Fellowship of the Ring. And I know that the tabletop industry has had many Lord of the Rings games over the course of the years, but I know the movies certainly elevated that fiction to a whole new level that wasn't present before. So I want to know, was the Lord of the Rings a game that you were commissioned to do? Did Cosmos or whoever approach you? Or were you already a fan of the story and you wanted to create a game surrounding that? Or were you looking for some way to implement a cooperative game, and the Fellowship of the Ring seemed like a great start to that?
There are two fundamentally different angles of starting points how game designs happen. One is that the designer, that I open my eyes, find something relevant in the world, which I am enthusiastic about packing into a game. That's a free design. I would work on it. And when the design, when the game, when the prototype is finished, I would then think about who is the right publisher. It would approach the publisher, would get turned down, go to the next publisher, get turned down. And finally, I find somebody who likes it and then it gets published. This is reality. But it is a free design, so I have something here in the show. The fundamentally other part of it, and that's what you are alluding to now, is when we are talking about a character license, a book license, a movie license, then I cannot just sit down and do a game about it because I don't have the intellectual property rights for that. So, And then I cannot, even if I got the intellectual property rights, which are sometimes quite risky because they're not inexpensive, then I cannot afford to go around and then talk to draft publishers afterwards and say, do you want the game? Do you want the game? Time elapses, the movie has passed, the movie is already out of date. And so the risk is far too big. So this is always in the constellation of a triangle, publisher, myself, plus the character license. It's not character license in me. So the starting point is there always something comes up which looks interesting. Either I raise it with the publisher or very often the publisher raises it with me, because the publisher, of course, very actively scanning the world of licenses. And then, so essentially it's an agreement between the publisher and myself to exploit, to use such a third-party license. And then the whole ball game changes, because there is a commitment to do it. There is a clear you have lost the freedom of shaping your own things. You know this is the topic. If you talk about the Lord of the Rings, you know very well there is a certain viewpoint of the book. Those people who buy the game usually know the story. They have a certain expectation. The viewpoint of the book is the Fellowship of the Ring. Therefore, also in the game, they would expect to see it from the viewpoint of the Fellowship of the Ring. Suddenly, you say, okay, so we need to be the Fellowship. So how can I, as Sam, take a knife and ram it into the back of Frodo to get the ring? This is not how it happens. So suddenly you are in a very cooperative environment. So essentially, inevitably, you get driven down a certain path, which I find fascinating. It takes a lot of experience, but it forces you to think new about design and how can I do justice to the spirit, in this case, of the book and the movie. And you talked book and movie. Of course, we had an ideal timing. We knew the movies would come out. Mm-hmm. And usually, the challenge with the movies is that even those people who license the rights for games, for example, get very little information. The movie makers are very, very secretive about the storyline, about the script, and so on. So you always only get it last minute, and then of course when you want, from a story point of view, and then when you want to think Star Wars, you never know what's really happening in the next movie. They're not telling you, because if they tell you, they tell other people, and it would just come out. Yes, so they're very secretive, but that means you get the story far too late to be in time out with the movie. And the second point is when you want to really go with the movie, you need to have the movie stills. And the movie, of course, will be shot very late, and the cutting of the movie. So it's all far too much pressured. And so with The Lord of the Rings, we had the really ideal situation that we knew the story, that we knew all the world. And so that we could get the license for the book much before the movie actually happened. And we didn't, to say this as well, we didn't have the trouble of getting all the approvals from the movie side, because we didn't do the movie. But of course, in the end, nobody cares if it's a game about the movie or about the book, because it's a game about the story, and the story is always the same. So we had it easy because we could start early, and our approval process was much easier because we didn't have to go with the steps of the movie. And then, of course, when the movie came out, it was a very nice promotion for our game, and we benefited a lot for it. Yes.
It was a very expensive commercial for your game.
Yes, that is a very one-sided view, but yes, it is. It was good timing, and it was a good setting of things. And it was also at a time where the licenses were not so extremely overloaded, because one has to realize with the renaissance of the gaming side, and also the gaming becoming a big business, also through the electronic side, of course, which is still more than 80% of the overall business is electronic games business, you get so many new releases every year that the question is, how do I differentiate myself from all the other releases? Yes. And so do I do it by price? You can ruin everybody else in the industry if you go low price. Do we do it by gimmicks? Gimmicks are a problem because customers will usually very quickly see that the gimmick doesn't lead very far. You lose interest in it. Then do I load it up with licenses, with character licenses? That usually forces you to go into big guarantees. So yes, you have something to stand out, but you have to turn a much bigger wheel. And so the world becomes more and more crazy in this, I want to be in front of the crowd, and everybody wants to be in front of the crowd, and not everybody can. And so everybody sees how they can stand out. Yes, and so this is much more hype today about the different licenses, and then they're much finer cut, and you get exclusive licenses for games with 52 cards, and the other one has an exclusive license for games with 58 cards. I mean, it is just madness. Yeah, but that's how the games industry goes.
Irrespective of whether or not it would be a great seller, and irrespective of whether or not you actually think you could get the license, is there one license that you, above all else, would love to design a game for? You know, is there some fiction or some story or some movie that you are particularly passionate about that you would love the opportunity to someday do a design for?
Nothing that right away springs to my mind, because I fortunately had the opportunity already to work with all these great Disney licenses. So I read Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck as a kid, and suddenly I'm doing games about it. There is Star Wars, there is Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit. So all the licenses are there. One book that really fascinates me, and now that we have a movie as well, is Ender's Game.
Oh, which of course.
Has itself the topic of gaming, yes, and so on. I'm fascinated by that book. I love the book. That's probably a challenge to do a game about a book about a game, yes. But I also have to be careful, because by driven, you are getting biased by being driven for the love of something, and you cannot really step back and have a good neutral objective view of, does that actually make sense? How strong is this license? If I'm too close to it, can I do a good job? And will the other people love this much as I do, and so on? So it's essentially the real, I mean, the answer to your question is essentially there are so many offers, and the world is so big at the moment that my pain is less to say, oh, I would like to do this license. My pain is more, I'm so limited in my time, and there are so many nice licenses which are really there for the grab, and I can't do them all. So how do you choose?
How have your tastes in games changed over the years? You know, what is once an incredible driving force for a type of game? I mean, when you look at some of those late 90s, early 2000s games that you were designing, these heavier, deeply, deeply strategic games that may be more impenetrable to a more casual audience. And then you've evolved over time to making different type of games, still strategically rich games, but also more approachable to casual gamers, families, yes. And does that reflect your own interests in gaming evolve?
It somewhat does, yes. I mean, it's a dangerous thing as a designer to say, I only design what I love. And do I love playing children's game? Not particularly. I mean, I wouldn't sit down in the evening and with three adults around the table and say, okay, let's get this kids game out and let's play it, yes. But I nevertheless, with great enthusiasm, I design kids games because it's a new challenge and so on. So it's a line between I only do what I love playing. So some designers just say I want the heavy games 2 hours, 3 hours more, and this is what I love, and therefore I only design these. I think that may not be the right approach. On the other hand, just saying it doesn't matter if I'm interested in what I design, it is not right either, because you have to have a certain relationship to it. The theme needs to gel with you. So it's a thing, keeping yourself open to other ideas, but not forcing you to do things where you cannot do a good job. Yes. So for me, I didn't really start out with the very complex games. It kind of happened that these more complex games, I became known for these. I mean, I started out with a lot of card games. Yes. A lot of card games, more little games, and I did also the bigger games. You named some of them initially, the Ra and the Samurai, and Modern Art came very early, actually, yes, and Quo Vadis was there, so the ones which are not as well known today. And Amon Ray is there, and so I think the community was very enthusiastic about these, and the community, of course, are the multipliers who then communicate and talk about it, and so maybe I got a bit more known for these. I then started to doing children's games. I also saw that, I mean, one of the origins of things was certainly when I go full-time game designing, I do not want to become a specialist and just take one genre and dig deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. It's so to speak. A specialist is a man who eventually knows everything about nothing because he can narrow. And I deliberately said, no, I want to widen my field. I want to look at different sectors, children's games, which taught me a lot of new things, how children approach it. Children take the pieces in their mouth, and they cannot have a structure in front of them because everything just shifts around. So you learn new things when you approach new categories, and that again refreshes and is fruitful for the other categories as well. Like when the mobile games came up, you suddenly need to develop something for a very small screen and nobody wants to read rules, and it needs to be very addictive. It needs to be very clear what you do. So it's essentially broken down to the one focus point, what do you play, and people, you want to still keep people playing for hours. And again, when you then go to the more complex games, you then see, okay, even if I have 2 hours, I don't have to be boring and slow. I can still try to use these simple mechanisms to keep the excitement going and have them flame up everywhere. So that's more, I don't think I've ever been in one corner and then tried to move out of a corner. But I realized for myself that when I sat down and said, what is actually my motto? What am I actually delivering? I came up with the motto, which is all on our letterheads and on my business part and everything, and you see it on the website, which is bringing enjoyment to the people. And why do I do my business? Because I want to make money? No. Why do I make business? Why do I do business? Because I like playing games? Nobody cares about it. What do people care about it? People care about, I'm working in the entertainment industry. People care about if I bring fun and enjoyment to them. And so once you realize that, it gives you a complete direction of what you do. And it gives me, it still today gives me a clear decision focus when I don't know which way to go. Then I say, bringing enjoyment to the people. Is that bringing enjoyment to the people? Otherwise, why do I do it? I'm losing the business basis. If people don't have any enjoyment, if people don't get any value out of what I'm doing, they're not interested in what I'm doing, yes? And so with this respect, yes, I have taken quite a deliberate step to try to reach a lot of people. The mobile phoning, everybody has the device in their pockets now. The smartphones give a good platform, but also in the basic classic games, I believe, this is my scientific approach again, I don't believe we need very complex rules to have a challenging game. Yes, it can be a very simple basis, but then the interactions between the players have to be interesting. So I'm not talking about simplistic and primitive games. And it's sometimes really the challenge to make a game which is not too complicated in the rules, but still have the depth of play. And that fascinates me today. And so I know I've given a long answer, and I'll try.
No, this is great.
Of course, my ambition is also to create new trends. I mean, looking around and saying, I don't just want to do what other people have done before. And when it has been done already, then it almost turns me off to go in this direction, because I say, well, all I'm doing is I'm running after what others have done. So there are, of course, new trends. Look at deck building games, for example. Yes, so cards seem to be the origin of a lot of new developments, not to speak about collectible card games a while ago, where I really told Richard Garfield it cannot work, he should give it up. And I still believe it can't work, but it's just another
Somehow it's managed to grab a foothold.
Managed to be one of the most successful parts of the industry in creating an own part of the industry and made Richard Garfield a multimillionaire and so on. But in the core, I still believe it. Collectible card games cannot work. Anyway, that's how wrong you can be. So coming back to, I'm always thinking of how can I, of course, find new trends. I mean, just now we had released the Eldorado, yes, which is essentially a deck building game. So now I'm doing a deck building game. Yes, I haven't invented the deck building mechanism. I would have liked to, but I haven't. But I then tried to give it a new approach, and I think that from a core deck building game, which is kind of a race game, and you have different territories and lots of different variations in there of how does the board look this time. You have many, many different ways how you can combine the boards, and depending on this, you need to play differently each time and the situation where the others are. So if I can't make the new trend, at least I want to give the new trend a different slant on it and want to go in a direction. But that was a very, very long answer now on the question of where do I come from and how do I evolve. It's in one sentence, it's keeping my eyes open and seeing what is relevant for the people and bringing them these relevant things in games. Because if a game is not relevant for the people, they will not touch it. And the relevance, of course, changes a lot. What was relevant 20 years ago is no longer relevant today. The movies change, the interests change, the world changes. Yes, and that means that is most important. I mean, Hemingway said it very, very clear. He said, in order to write, you need to live. And that there's nothing else, that you need to experience what people do, and then you can only do it. You need to start from the people, you need to start what moves people, what's people's emotion, and that changes. Yes, and in the games, that means you need to stay up to date with the fascination, what grabs people, and what opens them emotionally.
That is profound. And for you to drop a Hemingway quote on me is amazing. In fact, my old dog is sitting here right next to me in my recording studio, who is named Hemingway. So the fact that you're bringing this full circle to me is incredible. Now, Reiner, you seem like such a humble and down-to-earth person. Like, you're kind, you're generous, you're focused on bringing joy to the people, but you have almost like a mythic presence about you. I mean, when you're referred to on the internet, certainly on like Board Game Geek, you know, you talk about designers, and then you talk about Reiner Knizia, the doctor of game design. He's a legend. You know, there's garage bands, and then there's the Beatles, and you know, you have kind of this mythic presence, which goes along with other monumental designers and presences in gaming, like Richard Garfield or Gary Gygax with Dungeons and Dragons. How do you deal with that? With being such a humble person, do you find that off-putting that there's this incredible reverence for you, or does that come naturally to you?
I think in the main point, it is a responsibility, because people look a bit more of what you say and what you do, and I think it's the awareness that it has an impact sometimes what I say. So it's being careful and knowing and being aware of what I do. Otherwise, I mean, the nice thing is still, if in Munich I go down to the street, nobody cares about me, nobody knows me. Thank God that is the case. Actually, I was yesterday visiting my mother in my birth city in Illertissen, which is a 10,000 people city. And of course, there are newspaper reports all the time and so on, because I'm still the child of Illertissen. And so I go there, and then people come up to you and you don't know them and they recognize you. And so even so, I love this town. I could not live in the town because that's something I would feel uncomfortable with. But it's I think actually it is nice because game designers will never have a celebrity status like the big film stars. So in this way, I have my piece. When I go to the different fairs, to the different shows, of course, that's different than people recognize you. But then, of course, this is a good opportunity for me to connect with people, to really get down to the basics and see what they say and what they like and what fascinates them, what drives them, and so on. So it's, in a way, I'm a quiet, introvert person, but it's most of the time I sit here chained to my studio desk anyway and work on games, and that's fine. And then we play in smaller circles. So I don't think one should overemphasize this. There are lots of people who are good in their fields, and if you look around it, you meet them. There's actually surprisingly many people, if you just walk around down the street and you knew their background, there are many, many fascinating people. Of course, we only need certain facets of your game design, and then there are very few. And then you look into book writing, and there are a few authors. But if you take all the different aspects of the world together, we have a lot of great, outstanding people in that world.
Well, game design has become a designer-focused industry, I guess, or modern tabletop gaming. You know, people will buy a game because it's the latest Knizia game. People will buy a game because it's the latest Bruno Catala game or Stefan Feld. Names mean something, at least within this community, within this industry. When you were starting out, you know, when you were first getting interested in games as a child, maybe as a teenager, or even as a young adult, were you taking notice or interested in who were actually making these games?
Yes and no. I was, but that was in the 80s, and the world was different then. There were very few known game designers. Alex Randolph was one of them, or on the other side of the Atlantic, Sid Sexton. So these were, so to speak, the core fathers of game design, who also worked for getting the names of designers onto the boxes. And then there were some publishers coming up, and I know that Hans im Glück was a very small one-person publishing company, and they actually published one of the two first of my games. And I remember the first meeting with the then owner of Bernd Bunhofer of the publishing company. He had a very small booth in the corner of the Nuremberg Toy Fair, and I went up to him, we talked, we were both in Munich, and we got friends, and so we did lots of games together. Yes, so it was a much smaller industry. Also, Essen, the big convention with 150,000 people going there, was very small. It actually started in almost a school environment. Yes, with a few hundred visitors, and so the world was different. It was much smaller. So, with this respect, you can't compare it with today and say, okay, I had 20 idols and so on. It was more learning about the industry, taking in what there was. There was no internet. I mean, the world was completely different. It was much more insulated. Getting information about the games was not so easy. So it was more by mouth and going to the shops and seeing what there was, but much, much smaller than today. No electronic games. No electronics is not quite right, but they had not got the dominance that they have today. Yes. So I think I take my fascination less from people who work in my own industry. It's more about people who who do something great in the world, who I admire for standing up for something, doing something, achieving something, delivering something in any field that fascinates me, that kind of makes me feel my spine and shivers my spine, but that's less about he made a good game. It's much too narrow. It's just what are fascinating people in the world, what do they do in all different fields, yes, in all different aspects.
Is there an achievement that you still are focused on, that you something a milestone that you have not made it to, or is there a goal or an impact that you would still like to strive toward as you continue to design games? I understand that you said you want to bring games to the people, good games to the people, and that's important, and that's a great motivator. But is there a specific achievement that has eluded you thus far, but you are still working towards?
It's a very interesting point, because sometimes we discuss and say, wouldn't it be good to really do one of the fundamental games in the world? So if you say Scrabble or Monopoly or so, one may say, what have you done? And you name this one and everybody would know it, yes. Mm-hmm. And yes, you named some titles, and I think some of my games are reasonably well known, but they are not a Monopoly, and they're not a Scrabble, and they're not a Uno. Yes, so it's these are very unique, or chess. Yes, so these are very unique unique games. So sometimes when we start approaching new designs, you would say that what would we have to do today? Is it still possible today to create such a game, which Magic the Gathering is probably one of these? Is it still possible to do something with this? But then the other question is also, so if I achieved this, then what would happen? Then everybody would say, this is the man who did the Rubik's Cube. Yes. So you would then only be seen in this one dimension, because everything else would then fall aside. So I'm not even sure if I aspire. I mean, I wouldn't say no. If the universe gives me one of these, I would happily take it. Otherwise, it's really staying fresh and making sure that I myself, with my design, stay relevant for the people. Yes, so that I don't get stuck in the classic period of the 90s, where I think I made some contributions, but it's on old contributions you cannot rest. You need to be up to date here, and there are other designers who have other systems. The world goes in different ways, and so stay relevant, stay sharp, stay awake. I've done a lot of work on hybrid games. So you have a game, you still sit around the board, and you have some kind of an electronics in there. My very most successful game, who was it? So it's a cooperative game with electronics in there. And I had the opportunity to work on this, I mean, on a series of these games with Ravensburger. And it just seemed to have caught the... It's actually now, next year is the 10-year anniversary, yes, of the release of the game. We have caught the emotions of the whole family, because very often today people say, yeah, the 8 or 9 to 14-year-olds, we have lost. They are just in the electronics. You can't get them around the board. The family wants to sit around the board. And so having a board and having the electronics in there and having a little bit of we have to cooperate, otherwise we can't make it. So it's a group thing. So even the small child can come in there, because we want to help the child. I don't want to help the child beat me. That's always a kind of conflict. But here, we need your contribution. Therefore, we need to help you, need to bring you into the game so that we can win the game together. And we can either cheer in winning it together, or we can commiserate together having not made it and try it again, or we cheat a little bit with the system and we win it anyway. When people conspire against the electronics and are proud of, I mean, it just creates a group experience which is fantastic. And you need a little bit of luck, and I think we had the luck with some of the hybrid games. And again, it comes back to the same thing. Suddenly you sit there and you have to forget what you know so far. You're forced to look at what can this technology do and how can I make it affordable, how can I make it kind of intuitive to play and still create a good game and still create some innovation. So it's, I like these challenges. I think these challenges keep you fresh, and I'm looking out for these challenges. And this is also the worst for me if I'm busy and the publisher comes with a really new challenge and say, I can't say no to this one, yes.
Well, I could talk with you for hours. I could talk to you about your motivations, your inspirations, your views on the importance of gaming, on individual games. But I understand that you have to go make games. You know, you have only so much time and you need to keep on making those games. So before we end this, how about you tell me, you know, what are some of those fresh games, the games that you're passionate about, that you're very excited about, that either you've just recently released or you have coming out in the next few months to a year? What is really fresh and exciting that the good doctor of gaming is bringing to the world?
Yeah, so now you need to finish with a disappointment, yes, because I have one principle, and that is once I have given and licensed the game to a publisher, then I hand completely over the communication when something comes out to the publisher. So yes, of course, there are some highly exciting and I find very good games in the pipeline, but I cannot reveal what they are.
That's not a disappointment. That's an excitement. That's a teaser. I can't wait.
And of course, we are looking here at, I mean, one thing is we just moved to Munich, so I have my old group and a new group here, so I think we'll have some very fresh and refreshing approaches here. I'm working on one or two lines of games, which are new approaches, and hopefully they will do something. But as we said before, do I ever come back to my older design, my previous designs? I've quite answered it. Of course, I go back to them when we look at the core of these brands and say, do we not want to add something to this brand? Yes, we are currently doing this. I think that has been announced, if I can say it. We've done this with Medici, and so the new edition of Medici at Grail Games, but then also with the Medici card game coming out, yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of a fascination for me to look at designs and say, can I add a sister, a brother, or a daughter game to it, but introduce some modern elements of today in there? And so for you, I mean, just as this example, Medici is very heavily driven by the auction. It's a very, very clear mechanism, scientific approach, very clear mechanism, but it is also a very demanding mechanism, because if you get the auction prices wrong, you're off the game, yes. And quite a number of people today don't like these very hard auctions. So my challenge here was, can I not make a Medici game without an auction, which is still a Medici game? And so I think, and these are the challenges where I go back and I play the whole family of the old games. And Medici has, of course, Medici was a Strozzi, the Strozzi thing. And I've been working on one or two other families in this environment, which have failed so far. But I keep trying if I can do another one. And so it's not only make new trends and find something completely new. It's also, what do we have? And there are games which have been in print for 2-3 decades now. Yes, look at the classic series of Fantasy Flight, who have really picked up some of my strong games, and I'm very proud of the series and very thankful to Fantasy Flight now under the Asmodee umbrella that they do these things. So there's a magnitude of different things, and I continue to look at strong brands, and there is a strong brand of Lost Cities, and not about to say anything, but now that I have said it, forget it again. I don't mean that, but so there is something on the go there. And so it's so many things to do and so few turns is always the same in life. The good thing is I don't have to retire. I can do my games and design games as long as I want, as long as I live, and I certainly have the opinion that I want to do this. So I watched a very sad movie of Ayrton Senna, who stated a few weeks before he had his fatal accident, well, I'm only half through my life and I have so many things I can learn and so many things I can do. So on a reflective note, the best thing is to give your best every day. You don't know how many days you have left. Hopefully I'll be able to do another 600 games. Maybe the one which comes out is my last game. You never know. But you can only live as well as you can live and do what you love and try to give your best. And I'm certainly trying to do this.
I cannot think of a better way to end this interview. That it has been an absolute pleasure and an honor to speak with you, Rainer. Thank you so much for coming on to the Cardboard Herald.
It has been a pleasure to talk to you, and I really appreciate what you're doing with your heart and what you love for the gaming community. It's games bring the world together, brains bring people together, something which we not only need in our times, which we always need. And so thank you for what you are doing for the industry. All our contribution count, and I wish you really, really good luck with what you do. All the best, and thank you very much.
You pumped or what? I know I am. I want to go and play some of his games. I just want to hang out with him. I mean, really, this has been such a cool experience. And when I think about the greatest achievements of this podcast, of my presence in gaming, of my time gaming, the conversations that I get to have are memories that I will forever cherish, not just because I'm bringing them to you, but because I got to have them. I got to sit there with someone I have immense respect for, their contributions to my community, to the industry that I follow, and immense respect for their craft. It is so cool that I get to do this. And I never want you to feel like I don't think that this is amazing every opportunity that I can reflect on it. Now, if you are interested in the Cardboard Herald, find us at www.cardboardherald.com or on Twitter at Cardboard Herald. You can also subscribe to us, like us, rate us, do all those things for the podcast. It does so much to me to know that you are paying attention, that you care, and that you want to see more content like this. Pretty soon on the Cardboard Herald YouTube channel, I'm going to have a state of the podcast, kind of reflecting on the last 6 months, what I accomplished, what I didn't, what I'd like to do in the next 6 months to a year, how I'd like to expand this, some of the recent changes going on that have stopped or prevented me from doing certain aspects, and just the site, the entity, the reviews, whatever it is, I want to discuss everything having to do with the Cardboard Herald. So thanks for being along on the ride. I got some great recorded podcasts already in the bag, and I already have more scheduled for some great interviews upcoming. So thank you so much for listening to the Cardboard Herald. As always, I'm your host, Jack, and you out there, keep on gaming.
Hey, I'm Rob, and this is Casey.
Hey, hey.
We're from Paper Heroes. We both DM stories for an actual play D&D 5th edition podcast. If you enjoy or have ever been curious about D&D,
or just need a good story and an occasional laugh, you should check us out. We have an excellent group of people playing, including Jack Eddy here, who really bring the stories to life. We can be found at paperheroescast.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcatcher you use. Thanks for listening, and all hail He Who Reshapes.
Hail He Who Reshapes.